news when you want it. Get the latest headlines with the Bloomberg News Now podcast.
The latest developments in the war in the Middle East.
Inflation relief for consumers.
The top headlines from Bloomberg News, updated continuously throughout the day.
All in less than 5 minutes.
The House and Senate passing that spending bill.
Tesla's support among Wall Street bulls is weakening.
Get the latest news when you want it at the click of a button.
Now to the latest on the race for president.
Listen on Bloomberg.com.
The Bloomberg Business App.
And anywhere you get your podcasts. Bloomberg News Now. Context changes everything.
South Korea is a heavily forested country and is battling some of its worst wildfires ever.
Many houses, there's just nothing left.
What one of the hardest hit parts of South Korea is facing. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, why foreign tourists are canceling their trips to the U.S., including some from right next door.
I have never seen Canada come together like this before.
Israel has renewed its military campaign in Gaza. The top Palestinian diplomat at the UN tells us why he thinks that's a mistake.
They cannot negate and destroy the Palestinian people and continue denying them their rights.
We'll also hear about the political popularity contest between the presidents of El Salvador and Mexico and why the climate protest group Just Stop Oil is just going to stop. All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Welcome to the program. South Korea is dealing with its worst ever wildfires. They've been burning for days, killed more than 24 people, and forced tens of thousands to evacuate. Emergency crews across the southeast of the country are trying to put down the flames around cities like Andong.
Someone just described it like hell on earth, and it does look like that.
Journalist Yifong Bremer was there earlier today.
So Andong is a small city surrounded by mountains. Most of those mountains are completely set aflame right now.
Bremer spoke with me earlier after getting back to Seoul, the South Korean capital. He said the smell of fires really stuck with him.
There's a very thick smell in the air of smoke and burnt down wood and houses. And what you see is that the roads are just black. And the sides of the mountains where there used to be vegetation is now just bare sand. And that also brings other dangers, such as falling rocks. So all in all, it's just a very surreal terrain to navigate.
What about just physical damage to the area? How much damage have these fires done so far?
So I visited one man's house today, and he was living in a centuries-old traditional Korean house, his family home, that has completely been destroyed. Many houses, there's just nothing left but rubble. Some houses are still standing, and people are trying to put water on those houses so that when the fire reaches, their houses will not be destroyed. But most of those people have now also been ordered to evacuate because it's simply too dangerous in the area.
Wow. So as you said, officials in the area have ordered evacuations. What challenges are there for people to actually escape?
Well, one of the big challenges is what I noticed myself is that a lot of the signal towers for cell phone reception have just been burned down. It's in a lot of places impossible to reach anyone. So that makes you feel very, very vulnerable because you don't know exactly where the fires are coming from. And once you do have reception, it's kind of unclear where to go. People receive emergency texts to evacuate. And that seems to be also a struggle for authorities to centralize that information, especially a lot of the people in the area are elderly. So to reach those people also requires visiting them in person and telling them to leave the area. So all in all, a very challenging situation here for the firefighters and for the police on the ground.
I mean, is the government of South Korea equipped to handle a blaze of this size?
Apparently not. I mean, the fire started raging last Friday. It's been almost a week now. 36,000 hectares of land have been turned to ash. And 70% of South Korea is mountainous, and the majority of that has forests. So with climate change, and that's also what the local media here are referring to, South Korea does need a new system to be able to respond to these kind of disasters.
So you said 36,000 hectares, that's about 90,000 acres. Are authorities saying anything about the cause of these fires?
The cause is quite unclear. You do have small farmers sometimes doing controlled burns in areas. Some of them are illegal. But I think the biggest issue just been that it's been extremely dry in South Korea. And combine that with a strong wind, and even a cigarette butt can just ignite an inferno at this point. So this seems to be an issue that is not necessarily so much South Korea related as it is a global phenomenon of forest fires just happening more and more often and on a larger scale.
Ifong, you mentioned earlier rain had been hoped for today. What is the forecast for the next few days?
For the next few days, there's small pockets of rain expected, but whether that will be enough, that's just a big question, because today as well, there was a forecast of rain, but it just slightly missed the area where the rain was necessary. So the firefighters will have to rely on airplanes and helicopters for the time being.
Ifong Bremmer is a journalist based in South Korea's capital, Seoul. People across the globe are having second thoughts about traveling to the United States.
Dear foreigners planning trips to the U.S., cancel your plans.
I'm hearing all of these crazy stories of people being detained, people being denied entry. So now I'm nervous.
Do not travel to America. Do not travel to America for the next 4 years.
But it's not just social media influencers talking this way. European governments are also urging caution after U.S. immigration authorities detained several tourists in recent weeks. And then there are Canadians who have their own reasons for staying away. The World's Jeremy Siegel reports.
Curtis Allen loves the Oregon coast. The British Columbia resident and his partner were planning a road trip with their dogs in September.
This year was going to be our third trip down there, and we were getting excited for it. We invited some friends of ours to come along with us. We're going to make a whole thing of it, go for about a week and a half. And all that changed after the election.
Allen says when President Trump first started talking about making Canada the 51st state, he assumed it was a joke.
But it became very clear that the president was not joking about annexing Canada. And to be treated like this, we're taking it pretty personally. And we're going to be defending our country by not supporting another economy.
So he canceled his trip and says he isn't alone in that decision.
I have never seen Canada come together like this before. People of all political beliefs, walks of life, everybody is coming together. And I am seeing so many more Canadian flags.
According to experts, Allen is among a growing number of Canadian tourists ditching plans to visit the U.S. Airlines say interest in U.S.-bound flights is declining. And at the border, crossings by car are down too.
The latest data from Canada shows in the month of February, there was a 24% drop in auto travel from Canada to the U.S.
Adam Sachs is president of the global travel forecaster Tourism Economics. He says their predictions for international tourists coming into the U.S. this year are down sharply, more than 15%, due to souring international opinions and new guidance from governments warning their citizens about the risks of entering the U.S.
These are not only travel guidelines from governments, but they're viral anecdotes that just make people say, why would I want to go there?
One of those anecdotes involves the Canadian actress Jasmine Mooney, who starred in a film from the raunchy Y2K comedy franchise American Pie. In case it's been a while, here's a refresher.
Ladies! Well, tonight, boys, is the night.
You become a man.
Appearing in a movie called American Pie didn't ease her entry to the U.S. Mooney says she was detained for days after immigration enforcement flagged her visa application paperwork. She spoke to local media after returning to Vancouver last week.
There was no heads up. Next thing you know, I'm taken and for 2 weeks haven't been told anything, moved in different cells, sleeping on cement, sleeping in different jail cells. Nothing makes sense to me, and I'm still trying to process the entire situation.
In recent weeks, several German citizens have also faced immigration detention, prompting the country's government to update its travel advice, warning that a visa doesn't guarantee entry to the U.S. Elizabeth Schumacher is an American-born journalist with the German broadcaster Deutsche Welle.
This is going to make a lot of people think twice, and I've already had a bunch of friends say that to me, and my family are also, we're supposed to go to the U.S. in June. My husband is not a U.S. citizen, so it's something we're thinking about as well, if we should take the trip or not.
Schumacher says there's been a tangible shift in the way Europeans are thinking about travel to the U.S.
I think a lot of people thought, like, okay, we obviously don't agree with what the administration is doing, but that's a political thing. It has nothing to do with, like, life on the ground in the U.S. for me as a tourist. And now people are definitely reconsidering that.
Several other countries are also changing guidance for U.S.-bound tourists, including Britain, the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, and France, which is advising travelers to state their gender at birth when filling out visa applications. Greece recently signed a memorandum of understanding with Canada to promote tourism between the two countries, and experts say that could be indicative of an emerging trend: more travelers from Europe swapping burgers and baseball for poutine and hockey. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
The president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, enjoys sky-high popular support, the kind that most world leaders can only dream about. But yesterday, Bukele reportedly asked an AI chatbot, who is the most popular president in the world? And the answer that came back was Claudia Sheinbaum, Mexico's president. A viral moment in social media that reveals a rivalry, says Veronica Ortiz Ortega in Mexico City. She's a columnist for Heraldo de Mexico.
It's a little bit hard to explain. I don't know if it's related to popularity ratings. President Bukele started comparing the results in terms of security and homicide reductions in El Salvador compared to Mexico. As you mentioned, President Sheinbaum just took office in October last year, and she's enjoying sort of a honeymoon and also the popularity by his predecessor, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. But in terms of violence, of homicide rates, of course, Mexico is in a very dark place. López Obrador finished his six-year term with more than 200,000 organized crime-related homicides and also almost 100,000 abductions. That's a terrible legacy. And Claudia Sheinbaum is sort of changing the strategy. She's been a lot more assertive in cracking down the gangs and organized crime and even sending these kingpins to the U.S. But still, this is a huge tent to reverse. And Nayib Bukele is sort of very proud of what he's accomplished. And he started this sort of a comparison or competition with Claudia Sheinbaum, saying that he could not understand how other leaders in the world, and he cited Mexico's case, could not curb their homicide rates with the same drastic measures that he's imposed in El Salvador. But yes, he definitely cited Mexico's case in particular, even though Mexico is 50 or more times larger than El Salvador. But he said that within states that are smaller, you could start tackling, you know, one by one and obtaining the same result.
I mean, Bukele's draconian anti-crime strategy gets a lot of criticism for ignoring human rights. So how does President Sheinbaum respond to what Bukele says or tweets about adopting his strategy for Mexico?
So President Sheinbaum didn't want to comment on that, and she even said that she was not going to argue and that she just demanded respect, that both President Bukele and her had been elected by their people, and so they both deserved respect, and that respect was a foundation for diplomacy. And so she didn't want to escalate and said that she just wanted to treat President Bukele with respect and demanded the same respect.
So you mentioned a moment ago AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, Claudia Sheinbaum's predecessor. Did Bukele criticize AMLO? I guess what I'm trying to get at here is whether there are gender issues at play.
Yeah, I don't know. He sort of criticized because both AMLO, as he was known, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, and Sheinbaum come from the left, from opposite side of the political spectrum with Bukele. So he has been critical. But I think he hadn't mentioned like a targeted criticism as he did these recent days and, you know, the posts he's been putting on X. I don't know if there's sort of like a gender theme there or, you know, simply because he's now also getting the attention and he is collaborating more closely with the U.S. government. And Mexico is doing it, but not with its draconian measures at home. In fact, Claudia Sheinbaum is changing, you know, 180 degrees, the strategy that AMLO was famous for.
So do you think this tension between the two leaders is just kind of inside baseball and content for the political gossip mill, or does it force an even greater discussion in Mexico about how the government should deal with the violence there.
I think it's going to stay on this gossip level, because what AMLO was also famous for was boasting his approval ratings, being the second, you know, most popular leader, only behind Modi from India and above Nayib Bukele. But I think with Bukele, it's going to be not more than a gossip.
Veronica Ortiz Ortega is a columnist and podcast host at Heraldo de Mexico.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. I've spent the past 4 years investigating a crime.
When you're driving down this road, I might plan on killing somebody.
A 4-year investigation, hundreds of interviews, thousands of documents, all in an effort to see what the U.S. military has kept from the public for years.
Did you think that a war crime had been committed?
I don't have any opinion on that.
Season 3 of In the Dark is available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The war in Gaza started almost a year and a half ago. Israel's military campaign has killed more than 50,000 Palestinians, according to the health ministry in Gaza. The ceasefire secured in January is effectively over. Negotiations for another truce and hostage-prisoner exchange are deadlocked. We wanted to hear the views of Palestinian-American diplomat Riyad Mansour. He's the permanent observer of Palestine at the United Nations. In other words, Mansour represents the Palestinian people at the world body. I spoke with him this morning. Ambassador Mansour, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yesterday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel will seize parts of the Gaza Strip if the hostages held by Palestinian militants are not freed. Hundreds of Palestinians have been killed in the last week or so since the ceasefire ended. Why is it proving to be so difficult to end this war?
The answer to that question lies in the hands of Prime Minister Netanyahu. The mediators and those who were facilitating the help to continue with the second stage of the agreement, and here I'm referring to the United States, Egypt, and Qatar, were willing and still willing to try to bridge the gap between the different parties and not to descend into the finger pointing in order, you know, to sabotage.
So, Ambassador, if the situation had been promising under that ceasefire, what is the best way to get it back and make it truly permanent?
I think that the representative of the United States of America can play a very decisive role in getting us back on the track of stopping this tragic war.
Special Envoy Steve Witkoff.
They have the tools.
The tools of influence the U.S. has over Israel that you're referring to. Are we talking weapons, aid? What?
I know the United States has the capability of influencing Israel in so many ways and different ways, even, you know, political. It's just like we need to move in the path of peace and saving lives and stopping this tragic situation in which the Palestinian people lost more than 50,000.
Ambassador Mansour, what is your message to Hamas right now?
The message to Hamas is, the situation today is different than the situation that existed on October 6 of 2023. And my understanding, and I think the negotiator and the mediators, they know more better than me, that Hamas is saying that it's willing not to govern Gaza as it did before. It seems to me that there are positive signals. And I listened, you know, to the an hour and a half interview by Mr. Witkoff and Tucker, in which Mr. Witkoff was indicating that he needs to know the position of all the parties, including Israel and Hamas, and although he did not mention the role of the Palestinian Authority and the government of the state of Palestine, but there are some communication with our people in Palestine, with him and his team.
So, are you saying that Steve Witkoff has been engaging with the Palestinian Authority?
My understanding that there are some discussions and communications and ideas I am not involved in it. And I think it makes a lot of sense for him to engage with them, because the huge elephant in the room is not only Hamas and Gaza. It is the plight of the Palestinian people and the government of the state of Palestine and the Palestinian Authority and those who represent the authority under the leadership of President Abbas, and the future of the Palestinian people with regard, you know, to the two-state solution. So it makes a lot of sense for him.
Is it the relevant body, though, for this moment? Because many Palestinians have come to feel really let down by the PA. I mean, we spoke recently with Khaled El-Gindi from Georgetown University, who said the Palestinian Authority and its president, Mahmoud Abbas, have not been effective. They issue statements, he said. They make pronouncements, but they don't have a presence on the ground in Gaza. Does he have a point?
I think that this is not, a complete reflection of reality. For the reason I say that, for 15 months until we reached the ceasefire, who was managing the quietness in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem? It was the authority.
I have to say, I was in the West Bank just last April. It was not quiet. The Palestinian Authority police were few. And what was clear was that the IDF and settlers were effectively governing, not supporting at all the Palestinians, quite the opposite.
I know. I'm saying that we still live under occupation. And the one that has the upper hand is the Israeli army and the settlers, especially the armed settlers. That is part of our reality. But what I'm trying to say, that some elements among us were saying that there should be more revolt against, you know, our situation, and in solidarity in a certain way with our people in the Gaza Strip, although definitely the people in the West Bank and the Palestinian Authority and the president were supportive and sending everything, 50% of our resources and what we have to support our people in the Gaza Strip. But nevertheless, the one that was in control is, in reality, it's the occupying authority forces and the settlers who are armed and they're capable, and they were conducting attacks against the Palestinian people and in the West Bank and making their life miserable.
I mean, a lot of Palestinians say the Palestinian Authority is hopelessly corrupt. You favor giving them a second chance?
Well, I think that those who accuse us of such accusations, let them look at any government that they want and to tell us, you know, where is the free, pure society that corruption does not exist in them? I'm not saying that in order to justify anything. We are under occupation. We have tremendous amount of problems. We have all kind of issues that we need to deal with. And we are trying our best to govern in the most effective way, taking into consideration all these negative elements that are influencing our life and the way we govern.
I mean, you've kind of nicely encapsulated what's going on, but I mean, we have to recognize that in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, life has been getting worse for Palestinians. There's the expansion of Israeli settlements, Jewish settlers committing acts of violence against Palestinians, many Palestinian deaths and Israeli raids. Where is this all headed, do you think?
There is no option except to end all these things and for Israel to come to the realization they cannot negate and destroy the Palestinian people and continue denying them their rights. We can share this piece of land so that we can live in peace and harmony in our region and as neighbors to each other in a different way as we move forward. France and Germany, who fought against each other, two huge wars, World War I and World War II, in the span of the last 100 years, and now they are the two pillars of the European Union because of peace.
So you're saying, despite all the violence, forgiveness is possible?
It is very possible.
Riyad Mansour is the permanent observer of Palestine to the United Nations. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In the U.S., music's biggest night is the Grammys, but in Canada, it's the Junos, which take place this weekend. Along with expected categories like Single and Album of the Year, the Junos also hand out awards more specific to Canada, like Best Francophone Album. Alyosha Schneider is in the running for that one. Then there's Best Contemporary Indigenous Artist or Group. The rap duo Snotty Nose Rez Kids was nominated for 3 Junos. Canadian Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences is making some changes this year. It's dropping International Album of the Year and adding South Asian Music Recording of the Year. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on what led to this move and how South Asian musicians are reacting to it.
For the past 20 years, Satish Bala has put on Desi Fest, a festival celebrating South Asian music in the heart of Toronto. It's been a big success, but he says it wasn't all that long ago that South Asian music felt unwelcome in the city.
I remember the days where you can't play South Asian music in a public venue because the DJs will be shut down immediately, or you won't get venues because the mainstream culture, they didn't understand us.
A lot has changed over the past couple of decades. According to Statistics Canada, the country's South Asian population nearly quadrupled from 1996 to 2021. And Punjabi music in particular has exploded. Just a rock in the building. Bala says the genre got a boost back in 2002 when Jay-Z remixed Punjabi MC's Beware of the Boys. As soon as the beat dropped, we got the streets locked overseas. A Punjabi MC and the rock. More recently, in 2023, an artist named AP Dhillon became the first Punjabi musician to perform at the Junos. Then, Diljit Dosanjh was the first Punjabi singer to take the stage at Coachella. And last year, Karan Aujla made headlines when he became the first Punjabi to win a Juno Award.
This is definitely a first one, but not the last one.
And now, South Asian music has its very own category at the Junos.
I was pleasantly surprised. I didn't expect there to be something so specific.
Hashil is a Hindustani classical musician in Toronto.
And also very happy because finally I saw someone like myself on that stage, which is encouraging, I think, and rewarding.
Hashil, who goes by only one name, says this award is important for Canada specifically because of how many immigrants have come from South Asian countries. He hopes its existence will embolden people to release more music.
Definitely it was a fire under my butt to be like, okay, like there's a place for you to like do something with it now. There's a goal, essentially.
The new category is the result of a thorough research and proposal process, says Liz Morgante. She's the director of Academy Operations at the Juno Awards.
We had strong support from the industry, people coming to us to advocate for this new category, and then us also seeing the trends and the popularity of the genre.
Morgante says the Academy formed a South Asian Music Advisory Committee of industry experts to review the entries. The committee also helped guide the category rules. This award is based around language, so at least 50% of each submission must be in one of South Asia's many languages, which does not include English. The nominee is not required to be of South Asian descent themselves. That makes sense to Hashil.
I know one artist, she's Caucasian, but she sings in Punjabi and she sings in Tamil, right? So I would definitely hope that she could qualify because she's been training in Indian classical music for her entire life.
Satish Bala, the founder of Desi Fest, agrees, adding that South Asian music and the region's culture are meant to be shared.
The culture is not this thing that's like frozen in time in a little glass case and we look at it and we admire it. It's supposed to be like Play-Doh. You're supposed to take it, you're supposed to blend it, shape it, add stuff to it, and give it back to the next generation. This is what the power of music is, the ability to break down stereotypes. What you see and what you hear is not connected.
Another musician based in Toronto, Subha Shankaran of the band Auto Rickshaw, raises a different point. She questions the fact that the new award is based on the region's languages.
On my albums, I'm usually singing in about 4 or 5 different languages. I'm often singing in Sanskrit, in Telugu, in Tamil, in Hindi. But then I'm often singing in English because I want to keep hold of my audience and their attention and for them to be able to understand what I'm singing.
Looking back on her own discography, Shankaran says one album of hers likely wouldn't be eligible for this category.
That's kind of interesting to me, because a South Asian album is not about language, it's about the music. And yes, language is a part of it, but I don't know if it's 50% of it, in my humble opinion.
The team at the Junos say the language component of the category is a starting point, and each category gets reassessed every year to make sure it best reflects the genre. This week, nominees for the inaugural award are eagerly awaiting the ceremony. Among them is A.P. Dylan, who's nominated for his song, The Brown Print. Jonita Gandhi is also in the running for her song called Love Like That. Then there's Karan Aujla, nominated for his single, Toba Toba. The 54th Annual Juno Awards take place this Sunday in Vancouver. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, Toronto.
Just Stop Oil, the climate action group known for its disruptive protests, they say they're giving up their old ways and will no longer be carrying out high-profile stunts like throwing soup at a Van Gogh painting in a museum or interrupting sporting and theater events. Reporter Rebecca Rossman profiled the group on this program in late 2023.
Traffic has come to a standstill on this two-lane road in southwest London. Not because it's rush hour. It's actually nearly 11 a.m. It's because a group of more than 60 people in orange vests have stepped in front of traffic to begin what they call a slow march.
Oscar Berglund has done research on Just Stop Oil. He's a senior lecturer in international public and social policy at the University of Bristol in the UK.
So what our research has shown is that it's a very well-known organization. People know about Just Stop Oil. Most people strongly dislike Just Stop Oil, so they have very sort of high level of dislike amongst the public. They have been effective at getting media attention, but what they've been less effective at is getting their cause spoken about. So although there has been more attention to the issue of oil licenses, most people are unable to say that's what the demand is. So when we've asked people in surveys, you know, what is the demand of Just Stop Oil, only, you know, less than 10% of the population can say anything near what that actually was. But, you know, at the same time, their demand was made kind of policy by the current Labour government, which wasn't in power when they started.
So why has Just Stop Oil decided to stop these disruptive protests? What's behind that decision?
I think a lack of people, a lack of activists. So, I mean, they've paid a very high price, right? So, I mean, arguably, there's been a lot of criminalization against protest in the UK, as it has been around the world. Just Stop Oil has been targeted in that criminalization of protest. There are, you know, a lot of Just Stop Oil protesters in jail. One of the dangers pointed out with the kind of activism that they do is that it does have a very high price, and therefore it's difficult to recruit activists to the cause. So I think a combination of them being very unpopular and the protest itself having a very high price means that it's difficult to sustain a movement like that.
The Financial Times reports that members of Just Stop Oil have been arrested over 3,000 times and imprisoned 180 times. Is this a victory for the oil companies?
I mean, I think that the oil companies want to drive criminalization of protest. And yes, a lot of that has been directed at Just Stop Oil. But I mean, this is not the end of climate activism. So we have to, you know, see what other different forms arise of climate activism in this context. I wouldn't see Just Stop Oil stopping their activity as a victory for anybody. The climate movement will resurge and rejuvenate in different forms, I'm sure.
Do you think Just Stop Oil could have an impact on climate change activism in the future?
I think people have learned things from Just Stop Oil. I mean, so when people thought about climate activists, increasingly they thought about Just Stop Oil. That has not been, I think, to the benefit of the climate movement as a whole. People will have learned things from Just Stop Oil's successes and failures, And one thing that we see is that we see a turn to more kind of sabotage that is, in a way, you know, a bit more kind of extreme than what Justin Boyle has done. So more because people see that, you know, you are getting put in prison for nonviolent protest, then you might as well do some more daring things. I mean, that's one learning that people take. And another learning that other people take is that, well, you know, we need to do something that includes more people and that is more inclusive and that doesn't aim towards arrest, that doesn't have this focus on getting arrested as part of it. And that, therefore, by design, is kind of exclusionary of most people.
Oscar Berglund is with the University of Bristol School for Policy Studies. European boots on the ground in Ukraine, that was the main topic and the biggest point of disagreement during talks today in Paris. French President Emmanuel Macron said that European allies did not all agree on deploying troops to Ukraine should a peace deal be reached. However, France and Britain would forge ahead with the plan. It is not unanimous, Macron said today, but he added that we do not need unanimity to achieve it. It's been more than 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. In that time, Ukrainians have cultivated some national pride that had been starting to fade. One small example, more and more Ukrainian parents are signing up their kids for scouting, patriotic education and outdoor activities offered by an organization that's been around for more than 100 years. As Emily Johnson reports, the scouts' mission is to preserve Ukrainian culture and language.
A group of girls are gathered in a basement meeting space in the western Ukrainian city of Lviv. It's a weeknight, and they're singing along as their counselor, Olvia Kondratuk, strums on a guitar. Each wears a uniform, a beige shirt with merit badges sewn on, and a brown skirt, along with a red scouting neckerchief. They're members of the Ukrainian scouting program known as PLAST. This is the group for girls 10 to 12 years old. They're given a challenge. Who can build the tallest tower out of paper? It's meant to teach them how to work together. After a few wobbly towers collapse, Olvia announces the winner. She asks what they learned and what makes for a good team. Don't give up and work together, one of the girls says. It will all work out. Lviv is the city where PLAST was born, but there are branches all across the country. According to Lviv branch head Terena Doschak, they are adding 20 to 30 new groups a year here. We have about 1,200 children who are waiting in line in Lviv alone, she says. There's a queue in Ternopil, in Kyiv, and so on. Throughout the year, children attend weekly meetings, but the centerpiece of the program is the summer camps. Since the full-scale invasion in 2022, demand to enroll in PLAST is at an all-time high, but there simply aren't enough adult volunteers available to lead all the groups. Not when so many Ukrainians who grew up in PLAST are currently serving in the armed forces. But Doschak stresses that PLAST is not a military organization. This is very important to note. We are a youth organization that educates young people, she says. But many of our PLAST members are military members and profess our values that we are defending our country. Many PLAST members who join the military find that the skills they learned as scouts come in handy when fighting a war, skills like navigation and tying knots.
I usually say when people ask, what was war for you? I usually answer it was a big scouting camp, but Russians were just trying to kill us.
Andrei Zolab served as a commander of a medical unit in an air assault brigade for 2 years. He's been heading the veterans office here in Lviv. His military patches are framed on the wall, including one that marks him as a member of PLAST.
It was on my bulletproof vest during all the war.
He says he did his best to share the knowledge he gained from PLAST with his fellow soldiers.
I was explaining to farmers from villages how to camp, how to start a fire. It was against something about PLAST.
A major part of PLAST's mission has been to preserve and instill Ukrainian identity in children in the face of the Soviets' repeated attempts to stamp it out. Zolob's wife and older daughter are also scouts.
Part of great work of PLAST is growing that understanding in young kids. To be proud you are Ukrainian means to go to defend Ukraine if needed, to be happy with Ukraine, to be sad with Ukraine, to struggle with Ukraine, and so on, so on.
The history of PLAST is intertwined with the history of Ukraine itself. Born in 1912, it was banned during the Soviet era. Bogdan Hasyuk played a part in the rebirth of the organization in 1989, 2 years before independence. The first contacts were with the diaspora, he says. Lost members from overseas who had kept it going while it was banned were instrumental in bringing it back to Ukraine. Hasyuk became involved when a friend asked him for help taking kids to the mountains. Soon, he realized it was something much deeper. And then it started to spread, relaunching in different cities across the country, he says. A little over 3 decades later, on the third day of the current war, Hasyuk's son, also a scout, wanted to sign up to fight. Hasyuk went with him. He served for 2.5 months before he hit the age limit of 60 and was discharged. His son continues to serve. Ksenia Boluk is a PLAST volunteer who works with teenage scouts in Lviv. She says the war has created more programming challenges, like finding wilderness areas for summer camps that aren't mined or otherwise too dangerous.
First of all, it's a challenge of camping at all. And without camping, scouting is not scouting, actually. But we have a lot of challenges, like so kids were safe. We can camping only in a few regions in Ukraine.
But she says it's worth it to see the kids' faces when they find themselves out in nature.
Even in the time of full-scale invasion, we need to do camps, we need to have scouting, we need to have blast, because they have something else in their lives and something good in their lives.
After a jam-packed hour of activities, Olvia and another scout call their meeting to a close. The girls line up in a straight row. Before they head home, they sing a PLAST anthem about the forests calling them and about happiness, glory, and freedom. For The World, I'm Emily Johnson, Lviv, Ukraine.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. French actor Gérard Depardieu went on trial this week. Two women have accused him of sexual assault while on a film set in 2021. Much of the French public sees his trial as a milestone in the country's Me Too movement. It has also brought to light many other cases of sexual crimes far from the world of celebrities. From Montpellier, The World's Jerry Haddon brings us up to date on a difficult year of reckoning in France. Listener discretion is advised as the subject matter deals with children.
Depardieu denies the charges against him, says he's never sexually assaulted anyone. But in two shocking cases in France recently, both accused men told judges they are rapists.
C'est un procès qui choque et dérange tout un pays, la France et le monde entier.
This mass rape trial is disturbing.
First was the case of Dominique Pellicot, which drew international news coverage. Pellicot confessed in court to regularly sedating his wife over more than a decade so that he and dozens of other men could rape her. He filmed it, kept records. In an uncommon move, Pellicot's former wife and victim, Giselle, chose to go public with the charges. She said it was to shed light on sexual violence. She became an instant Me Too icon.
Grâce à vous tous, j'ai la force de mener ce combat jusqu'au bout. À toutes ces victimes...
Upon leaving court after one session in December, she said she'd found the strength to come forward thanks to her many supporters. No victim is alone, she said. Just look around. Outside, hundreds of supporters chanted and held up signs in solidarity. But one read, 70% of all reported sexual crimes involve children. Another, 160,000 minors in France have been victims of sexual abuse. The placards might have seemed out of place at the Pellicot trial. Giselle Pellicot is 72 years old. But there was another trial looming, France's biggest sex crimes trial ever. It involves pediatric surgeon Joël Lescournec. He's accused of abusing 299 children, the average age of his victims, 11. Like Dominique Pellicot, he has said, "Yeah, I did it. I've done hateful things," he told the judge last month. Victim Amélie Lévesque would agree.
J'ai été opérée en 1991 à Loche par le docteur Lescournec d'une appendicite.
Dr. Lescournec performed an appendectomy on me in 1991, she told French television outside the trial. I couldn't fully remember what he did after, but it brought me a lot of psychological problems, she said. It prevented me from having a normal life. Lévesque was 9 at the time. As an adult, she underwent various therapies to recover lost memories, and it worked. For those who might doubt her story.
En 2019, j'ai appris vraiment que j'étais dans les carnets. Ça a été
2019, she recounts, I learned I was in the diaries. It was like being hit by a tsunami. The diaries were the doctor's. He wrote down nearly every crime, dates, names, what he did. The abuse spanned decades, but it wasn't until 2017 when a six-year-old girl told her parents of unwanted touching that someone called the police. Fellow physicians had reported suspicious behavior to France's National Council of Doctors, but the council never took action. I wrote asking to interview someone, but a spokeswoman said the council is reserving testimony for the trial. The trial started in February and is being followed closely across the country. In France, Me Too didn't catch on until years after it started, back in 2006 in the U.S. Some famous French women actors even pushed back against it. But with the Depardieu trial, France is having its Me Too moment. In the southern city of Montpellier, I asked some young women, college students, about how they view Me Too in light of all these high-profile cases.
Ah, c'est un progrès que la parole se libère, mais du coup, c'est vrai qu'on est de...
We've made progress with our right to speak out, says 21-year-old Sarah Maren. But at the same time, we're backed into a corner because the reality here is coming out, she says, for example, with the Pellicot case. We're learning that all these crimes still go on, she says. It makes it all the more tragic. Each time we make some gains, advance a bit, says fellow student Lise Le Borgne, we realize that we still need even more time for people's mentalities to evolve so that women are treated respectfully. For now, the more women denounce their aggressors, the more aggression that comes to light. It's part of what happens when you expose abusers, and women hope it will lead to swift justice.
J'espère vraiment que ça s'arrête et de passer à autre chose et que voilà que la justice reconnaisse que je suis victime.
I'm just hoping all this will end, said victim Levesque, to move on. May the justice system recognize me as a victim and condemn Joëlle de Scornec. We can never fully turn the page, she said, but we can rebuild. In the Pellicot trial, Dominique Pellicot got 20 years for his crimes. Le Scornec will likely spend the rest of his life behind bars. The trial is set to end this spring once his victims have had their chance to confront him in court. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Montpellier, France.
Let's take a quick side trip now to a small village in the northern part of Burkina Faso in West Africa. It's called Lankoué. It's right in the middle of the very arid and scrubby Sahel. Singer and storyteller Kaito Wince was born there into a family of griots. It's a big responsibility. As a griot, Kaito is a guardian, a keeper of oral traditions, stories steeped in his ancestors' history. Kaito is now sharing some of these proverbs with listeners well outside of Lankoué. In this tune, Reyele Bombu, Kaito sings in Moré and Samo, two languages in Burkina Faso. Reyele Bombu means having good support. As he sings, if you've got 2 feet, you've got to have support. You've got 2 hands, you need support to live. The overall theme in these proverbs and ancient sayings are words of courage, hope, and optimism. As a griot in the 21st century, Kaito delivers these messages from his new home in Brussels. He says he's unearthing the bones of our ancestors and transforming them into a ladder. So to extend the metaphor, think of each proverb or song as a rung on that ladder, allowing us to climb to a peaceful future. That is The World on this Thursday. Be sure to join us tomorrow for a look at the new direction of U.S. foreign policy.
We're basically saying that the allies don't matter to us as much anymore.
Former Ambassador Nick Burns looks at the first months of the Trump administration, what we've learned so far about how the president is approaching diplomacy. That's tomorrow here on The World. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. As always, thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org.
by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Glasscock Heritage Trust, Jennifer Woodruff, Cindy Engels, Merle Kurtzrock and George Zimmerman, and Carrie and Nelson Hoffman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.